Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today in WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to be talking about the economy, press coverage of the economy. We'll be talking about Latin America, the breaking stories there, the press coverage there, and we'll be talking about media in general, news media in particular. We'll have a wonderful guest for you, one of our favorite guests here at Media Matters, Mark Weisbrot, will be joining us. But first, before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Last week, we reported that Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota introduced a resolution of disapproval to overturn the Federal Communications Commission's decision to lift the ban on newspaper broadcast cross-ownership. Media activists are rallying support for the bipartisan bill. Studies show that media consolidation harms minority media ownership and localism. Ryan Williams is with the National Association of Black Journalists.
You know, the numbers right now are pitiful in regards to African Americans. African Americans make up just 5% of newsroom employees at daily papers. We know that when there are diverse owners, there are diverse staff.
Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women, echoed Williams' call for diverse ownership. She says women are outraged by sexist, racist, and homophobic comments and the prevalence of violence and sexual exploitation on TV.
I think that all of this is a direct result of the lack of diversity in ownership, with women owning just 5% of commercial broadcast television stations and 6% of full-power radio stations.
Josh Silver, executive director of Free Press, also talked about the need for increased minority media ownership. He talked about the importance of journalism.
Journalists get laid off in the name of synergy. Investigative journalism is replaced by tabloid fluff. And we're seeing increasingly the homogenization of content on radio, television, and in print.
Hannah Sassaman is campaign director of Prometheus Radio Project, which won a lawsuit against the FCC back in 2003 when the agency last tried to change the ownership rules. They are once again taking the agency to court unless the Senate acts first.
When you look at millions of people standing up to the FCC and standing up and getting Congress to fight for them, what you're looking at is an American veto of what the Federal Communications Commission has done. And that has resonance in the public sphere as well as in Congress as well as at the commission.
You just tuned in to 90.5 FM, WRTE Radio Arte.
Radio Arte, 90.5 FM, is Chicago's Latino-owned, youth-driven, bilingual public radio station. The 73-watt station has been unusual from the beginning. In 1996, the National Museum of Mexican Art acquired the license from the Boys and Girls Club. Radio Arte's general manager, Sylvia Rivera, says the museum didn't know about running a radio station, but they did know they wanted young people in charge.
Our growing up, I guess, as an organization has oftentimes been a case of trial and error, but in it, we've been able to find some, I think, innovative approaches to not just creating radio, but in terms of leadership development for young people and having young people be decision makers.
Rivera knows firsthand how effective the program can be. She was one of the first to be trained as a radio journalist at Radio Arte in 1998. She says being given responsibilities and learning project management skills was part of a bigger picture.
Really seeing not just radio, but media in general as an important key in framing social justice issues and also being interactive with our community, not just giving information, but also engaging the listening community.
The program trains young people from 15 to 22 years old. Rivera says that often they come in with the idea that radio means doing a music show and being a DJ. But once they become engaged in conversations about immigration, the LGBT community, or housing problems, they become invested in these issues.
To see the evolution of young people into becoming well-versed individuals that can often advocate and become ambassadors and spokespeople for these different causes has been very rewarding. We really want to be seen as a national model for what Latino public radio can be. There can be a model for bilingual radio in an urban area, one that is entertaining and educational and enhances the radio programming by producing events that complement radio programming, thus again engaging the community.
Radio Arte recently was honored with a Studs Terkel Community Media Award, given to outstanding media professionals for excellence in covering and reflecting Chicago's diverse communities. The ceremony is in April. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and one of our most favorite guests here on Media Matters, Mark Weisbrot. Mark, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be back.
Well, I think this is the third time we've had you on. Is that, do you know offhand?
I can remember, I think, one or two other times. It's been a while, though.
Well, too long, but it won't be too long because you're one of the real experts on a couple of areas of a special interest to me and to our listeners and of pressing interest in the world today, specifically Latin America, but also the state of the U.S. economy. And but before we get into both those things, I'd like to ask you about a column you wrote just this week that appeared on Alternet. The headline was, Media Needs to Take More Responsibility with Regard to False Information. And what was the motivation for that column, Mark?
Well, I guess there's a whole series of issues, and some of which I didn't even mention in the column, where the media is the worst, where the media continually has an enormous influence on politics by reporting bad information or repeating false information that's said by others, until large numbers of people believe it. And I gave a few examples in that column, but I guess what originally inspired me to write it was the recent events in South America, where you had Colombia invaded Ecuador, and all the countries of South America, including almost everyone, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador itself, of course, there was a huge outcry against this violation of Ecuador's sovereignty, and the president of Colombia, President Uribe, had to, after first, defending everything he did and being very aggressive, had to apologize, had to promise never to do it again after the Rio summit in the Dominican Republic, and yet a good part of the media still spun it as kind of a victory for the United States and its ally, Colombia. And they also, they also have been reporting about all these documents which were supposedly recovered from a laptop that, even though the whole area was bombed to the point where, bodies were dismembered, they managed to recover a laptop supposedly belonging to a commander of the FARC, the guerrilla group that the Colombian government was attacking, and they so now these documents are all over the media, the reports of these documents, but there's been no independent confirmation that any of the stuff supposedly in them is real, and they're using it to say that Ecuador has been supporting the FARC and the FARC contributed to the campaign of President Correa of Ecuador, and that Chavez was supposed to give $300 million to this guerrilla group. And there's no evidence, and yet the media is just reporting this as, in many cases, almost as if they were established facts.
In fact, if I can interrupt for a second, Mark Weisbrot, I was just reading the most recent edition of The Economist, which is, considered one of the finest examples of journalism in the English-speaking world today. And not only did their article and coverage of the Colombia-Ecuador Venezuela incident include what you just said, but they went on to suggests that Chavez is almost trying to provoke a war to save his faltering regime.
Yeah, that's the theme, and in fact, that's what President Bush said just this week, just last week as well.
What a strange coincidence.
Yes, and it's interesting because, you know, that's an enormous distortion as well. I mean, you know, the Venezuelan economy has been the fastest growing economy in the hemisphere for 5 years now, since the government got control over its most important industry, which is the oil industry. You know, that was nationalized back in 1976, but it was controlled by the government's enemies until their last attempt to overthrow the government with an oil strike, which ended in February of 2003. So for 5 years now, since the government got control of the oil industry, the economy has grown more than 87% in real terms. That's adjusting for inflation. That growth has not been in the oil industry, which has hardly grown at all. So the vast majority of that growth is the rest of the economy. They've cut unemployment in half. They've cut the poverty rate in half. They've increased social spending per person by more than 300%. They provided health care to poor people, millions of poor people, almost the majority of the country. They've provided subsidized food to 40% of the country. So they do have some economic problems, as any economy will run into if it grows at this kind of speed over a five-year period, including inflation and some shortages over the last year and a half. But the idea that Chavez has got to distract attention from some kind of terrible situation at home is really a fantasy of the opposition there that's just repeated in the media.
And then the other side of the equation is Colombia. And from your perspective, what about Colombia and the U.S.-Colombian relationship maybe isn't getting a lot of attention in the news media?
Well, this whole series of events in the past couple of weeks, or the past couple of months, if you want to go back a little further, what's happening, what's provoked all of this is that back in November, you see, the FARC has been fighting for 40 years. It's a guerrilla group in Colombia. And the Colombian military and the government, I can't speak for their government, so I don't know exactly who believes what, but the government appears to believe that they can win this war just militarily, even though they've been able to do so for more than 40 years. And so they want to just, they think they can do this. And the United States, of course, has the same, the Bush administration, no negotiation with terrorists. And so they frame this into, a war on terrorists like they do with, all conflicts in the Middle East and everywhere else. And so they think they've got a winning line. You know, we can call these guys terrorists, and they do commit acts that would be considered terrorist, although you have to, the media doesn't emphasize this, but the government, including the army and affiliated death squads, have killed many, many more people than the guerrillas have in terms of civilians, innocent people. But nonetheless, so they only call non-state actors, terrorists. And so on the basis of this, they think they can just win. Now, there's been, and then they just want to keep fighting away. Now, and in fact, in the last few years, the human rights groups have documented a surge in killings by the Colombian army because they've demobilized some of the paramilitary death squads under pressure from, international human rights movements. And so now the army is killing more of the civilians themselves. So this is the kind of background of the conflict. And what's happened is the government of Colombia has come under pressure a lot from Europe, because Europe, France, the president of France has made it a personal cause because of pressure from within his country and the European Union. To try and get Ingrid Betancourt released. She's being held by the FARC, and she was kidnapped in 2002, and she was a presidential candidate, and she's a dual citizen of France and Colombia. So because of this international pressure, the government is getting pressure to to actually negotiate with the FARC for the release of certain high-profile hostages, including three U.S. military contractors that were captured there, but which our government doesn't seem to be interested in at all, again, because of their position of no negotiation with terrorists, in securing their release, although the families are, and they've been exerting pressure as well. So under this pressure, President Uribe of Colombia, back in November, authorized President Chavez of Venezuela to act as a negotiator, a mediator, because he had confidence in both sides. Now, this is something the media doesn't really, again, report very well. Chavez has had a very good relationship with Uribe, despite the being at opposite ends of the political spectrum. They've maintained a very good relationship through virtually all of Chavez's 9 years in the presidency, because Chavez himself, you know, does not want a war. He doesn't want conflict with Colombia. So he was appointed to be mediator, and then Uribe did something which Chavez considered to be a stab in the back. In November, he just as they were nearing success, he pulled the rug out and fired Chavez, and said without even talking to him, which was considered very rude by the Venezuelan government. And he did this on the grounds that Chavez had talked to one of his generals when a Colombian senator had passed the cell phone to him, and he talked to him for maybe a minute or two, and that was a violation of the agreement. And so so Chavez got very angry and saw this as a pretext, also because President Bush had called Uribe that day, and he saw it as just, you know, the United States not wanting these negotiations to go through, and he got very angry about it. And he continued to try and negotiate, and then Uribe did another thing that Chavez also considered to be the second stab in the back. They had arranged for the release of these hostages on New Year's Eve, and all these people from all over the world, officials from the Brazilian government, the former president of Argentina, France, Switzerland, Ecuador, Bolivia, everybody was there for this, because all of these countries have a stake. They all want this conflict to reach a negotiated solution someday, even though it's far from that. And they see the hostage release as a step in that direction, some kind of talking, some kind of negotiations. And then what happened was the military was supposed to, Colombian military was supposed to not engage in ground or air operations in the areas where the guerrillas were against them, so that the delivery could take place. And they didn't. They went ahead and did that, and so the delivery could not take place. And this was a real example. I think this is one of the most, since this is a show about media, this is one of the most compelling examples of media censorship that I've seen in at least a year, the coverage of this, because Uribe claimed that the FARC had no intention of delivering the hostages at all, that in fact, because they didn't have the boy that they thought they had, one of the hostages gave birth to a boy in captivity, and they thought they had him, and they didn't because they had left him with someone else. He said that they never intended to deliver them at all, and it was all just a ruse. Whereas the FARC and Chavez said no, they intended to deliver these people, but in fact they came under heavy fire. And so what happened? As soon as the hostages were released, one of the hostages, they were released eventually on January 10th. The FARC delivered them to the Red Cross and to the Venezuelan officials. And what happened was, as soon as they were released, one of the hostages, Clara Rojas, said that in fact they were about to be released on New Year's Eve, and they came under very heavy fire and bombardment from the Colombian army, and they had to hide, and that's why they weren't released. So this is a major embarrassment, of course, to Chavez and to everybody who was, you know, hoping for this release. And it was done very deliberately. So that was the truth to the matter, unless you think the hostages themselves were lying. And the media did not report that. You could only find that in the Latin American press.
Our guest Our guest today on Media Matters is Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Mark Weisbrot's been a frequent guest here on Media Matters and is an expert on Latin American politics and economics and on American economics and politics. We'll be talking with him throughout this program about Latin America, about the United States, about the state of the economy. Let me remind you, dear listeners, this is a pre-recorded show. We taped it a few days before airing today, so please don't call in. Sit back, relax, and let Mark Weisbrot and me, Bob McChesney, do the yakking today. Mark, I want to wrap up a little bit more on Venezuela before we head north. And, you know, one of the recurring themes in the press coverage of on Venezuela, and not simply on Fox News, but I think across the board, virtually with the exception of maybe The Nation magazine and publications on the progressive wing of the political spectrum, is that Venezuela is a nation that, you know, unlike other nations in Latin America, has shown almost singular contempt for free speech, freedom of the press, conventional liberties, as we know them in the United States, and that it has also, looks to be a threat to its neighbors, that it's trying to consolidate a totalitarian system and export it around the continent. These are almost unchallenged in press coverage and said commonly or implied commonly in places like The Economist and by government officials. You've studied Latin America a lot. How close to reality is this assessment?
Well, it's quite Orwellian, actually, because Venezuela is actually a fairly open and democratic society. And it has one of the most, and possibly the most, oppositional medias in the hemisphere, much more than ours. And, you know, you mentioned The Nation, but in fact, The Nation has run some pretty bad articles on Venezuela, one or two good ones, but this is what happens. It's a very good example. You don't really have anyone in The Nation even who understands what's going on there, because the media coverage is so hegemonic that you get to the point, it's much worse than, say, the coverage of the Iraq or the Middle East, where even people who are normally skeptical about the media lose their sense of reality. And this is clear to anybody who goes there. I mean, you turn on the TV and or the radio or pick up the biggest newspapers, and they're trashing the government, beyond the level that you would have seen, say, from Fox News during the Clinton impeachment. Now, there was one TV station that lost its broadcast license, and, you know, we both wrote about that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a station, again, that, wouldn't have gotten a broadcast license anywhere else in the world because they actively organized a military coup against the government in April of 2002 and committed other very serious violations which would have landed them in jail in most countries. So, but there's no censorship, and the media, again, if you add up all the media, radio, TV, newspapers, you have a more oppositional media than you have anywhere in the world, or anywhere in the hemisphere. And you also have, the government has, democratic elections that are certified by international observers. And in fact, Chavez lost a referendum on December 2nd. It was a controversial referendum. I went to support it. Some of the constitutional changes that were in there, but the main point is that as soon as he lost, he didn't even wait for the final results. It looked like he was going to lose by a very tiny margin, which was about a few tenths of one percentage point. But because they have a very good electoral system there, it's extremely accurate and fraud-proof. He knew that the government knew that they were going to lose, and so Chavez said, congratulations to the opposition, go out and celebrate, and that was it. And, all over the media, you before the election, there were all these things about he would never accept the result. It was his first loss out of 11 elections. And in fact, 2 weeks later, Chavez announced that they were going to slow down this 21st century socialism that he wanted to, that the voters actually voted for, by a very large margin, just at the end of 2006, and because and to concentrate more on some of the things and administrative things that people cared about, and so you saw kind of the opposite of what happened in the United States when we voted against the war in the 2006 congressional elections, and we were met with the surge. So by measures, you know, any measure you want to use, either standard political science measures, or if you want to use the, you know, more left of center measures of participatory democracy, or even the simple definition which gets lost in Washington quite a bit, which is, do people get what they voted for? Venezuela is quite a very democratic country.
Then, Mark Weisbrot, why the hate for Venezuela? Why the contempt? Why the anger? Why is it presented, I think, from my assessment, as the number one threat to democracy and peace in the Western Hemisphere now, except perhaps for Cuba, but I think Venezuela is seen at this point as far greater threat.
Yes. Well, one thing is it's an oil state, and you know, the United States has a pattern of not of seeking regime change in oil states, Iraq, Iran, Iran back in the 50s. I mean, you know, any time you have that much oil, they're sitting on what this year might be declared to be the largest oil reserves in the entire world. And so, you know, it isn't the oil per se, which I think a lot of the left believes mistakenly. It's the oil as a source of power, and Chavez has used that wealth in a very constructive manner from the point of view of South America. He's provided, you know, just last year, $9 billion of aid to other countries, including Argentina and Bolivia and Ecuador and Nicaragua. And so these countries, even the poorer ones that previously would have been subject to a lot of financial pressure from the United States and from the whole creditors cartel run by the IMF, they're now much more independent in the whole region. In fact, South America, I would argue, is more independent of the United States than Europe is today. And this is a major change. And Venezuela is only part of the story, but it's a very significant part because it has an independent president who's willing to use his the country's an independent government, I should say, that's willing to use their oil resources to help, you know, secure the independence of the rest of the region.
Mark Weisbrot, we get little coverage of Latin America in the U.S. news media, and when we do get it, it's along the lines generally of what we've been talking about, which is it's the issue that concerns the White House or the State Department or the Pentagon, and oftentimes framed as they would see it. Aside from Venezuela, what else is happening in Latin America that many Americans might not know about and other nations that sort of holds to the thesis you're putting forward?
Well, there's quite a bit. As I said, this is a sea change in Latin America, this whole region of 550 million people becoming independent of the United States as they haven't been for more than 150 years. This is very big. I think also the kind of natural resource nationalism, which is occurring in other parts of the world as well, but, you know, Bolivia getting control over its natural gas and hydrocarbon resources has been able to collect an extra $1 billion in revenue, which, you know, would be like $1.4 trillion in the United States, and they're beginning to build schools and hospitals and provide you know, increased pensions for old people and things like that. And they, of course, they've broken with the IMF after 20 years of being under IMF agreements. Ecuador is also moving in that kind of progressive direction as well, having elected a progressive president. Argentina is a very interesting story as well, that now President Cristina Kirchner is there, but the government has maintained her husband was there previously, and she was elected at the end of last year. And she is, and they've also moved in a direction that has enabled them to, you know, pull 11 million people out of 39 million people across the poverty line over the last 5 years, and broken with a whole set of failed economic policies, and defaulted on $100 billion of foreign debt along the way. So all of these developments are very significant. They're the seven countries in South America, which includes, you know, Brazil and Argentina and Venezuela and Bolivia, Ecuador, Uruguay and Paraguay, have all joined up to form this new Bank of the South, which is an interesting institution and explicitly designed as an alternative to the IMF and the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank, which all of these governments believe we're not meeting the needs of development in the region. So,
now, is this getting much coverage in the U.S. news media?
Well, Latin America is not covered that much, and I kind of hesitate to try and encourage them to cover it more because, it, you know, given the kind of coverage we get here, it's, you know, it's often true that no coverage is better than coverage. But no, it doesn't get that much. And what they miss really is the trends. They frame this whole thing as a fight between Chavez and Bush, or the rise of anti-Americanism, or the rise of irresponsible populism. Those are the framework, or a Cold War framework, you know, an axis consisting of Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, and sometimes Argentina, depending on whether they want to be put, you know, whether the Washington Post wants to put them on the bad list or not. And those are the kind of frameworks you see, rather than, I think, you know, the more accurate framework, which is, you know, the people basically went over the heads of their governments after the worst economic failure in more than a century that lasted 27 years, and voted new leadership into office, and that, you know, these governments are trying to deliver on some of their promises.
Our guest is Mark Weisbrot. You're listening to him. He is the co-director for the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here on WILL AM 580. Please don't call in today. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it just a few days before going on air. And Mark, I'd like to turn now to domestic issues in the United States, economic issues and politics and media issues here as well. But before I do, tell me a little bit, if you would, about the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which you co-direct.
Sure. Well, the center was started, let's see, about 8 years ago, and we do about half of our work on international and half on domestic issues. And we basically try and take the most important economic issues that people need to understand in order to you know, represent their own interests, basically, and try to explain those. We do a lot of work with press, with media. We write a lot of papers, some of which are technical, but mostly try to make them understandable, and looking at the big economic issues of the day.
Well, one of the issues that the center has worked on a great deal is Social Security, and your running mate, Dean Baker, of course, is one of the great experts on that subject. But you also write about it, and you write about the way the press and politicians deal with Social Security and how misleading it is.
Yes, well, that's a problem. And, you know, you actually saw that surface for a little bit when Obama tried to attack Hillary Clinton kind of from the right on the issue by saying she wasn't doing much about Social Security. And we wrote about that, and so did some others, and he kind of dropped the issue. But I think he didn't know because, you know, you do have this. I mean, Tim Russert is up there every time he mentions Social Security on the Sunday talk shows. He's always saying there's some kind of crisis, we've got to do something about it. And, in fact, you know, the program is good for nearly four decades without doing anything at all. And then even if you never did anything, which isn't going to happen, it would still pay a benefit higher than what people get today, even, you know, in real terms adjusted for inflation. So there's really no significant problem there.
You know, but Mark, on the Republican side of the aisle, I've watched several of their presidential debates. I mean, it's a point of pride for virtually every candidate to announce that the system's nearing collapse. Are they just, why, how could, if you're correct, how could they be, you know, mangling up the numbers that badly?
Well, they don't really, you know, that's the funny thing about this. You know, I co-authored that book with Dean, which we did from the University of Chicago Press in 2000. And in there, you know, we just go through the various little tricks that people use. It's just a series of kind of verbal and accounting tricks. So it isn't even as complicated as somebody coming up with their own estimates that differ from what the Social Security trustees or the Congressional Budget Office uses. So everybody's using the same number.
Okay, let me reframe that, Dean, Mark, just so I get to the point I'm trying to get at. If, you know, given all the demands on the budget of the United States today, military and whatever we have to, housing, health care, bridges and infrastructure, why aren't all politicians, Republicans and Democrats, like, delighted that actually Social Security is in pretty good shape, so they don't have to worry about that when they put their attention elsewhere? What drives this need to, you know, change Social Security?
Well, this is a good example of what we talked about at the beginning of this show. These right-wing groups, the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, back in the early 80s, late 70s, they started pounding away on this idea that Social Security was going to go broke, and with the idea being a very clear motivation, they wouldn't even deny it at Cato, for example, being that convinced people that they didn't really have a stake in this system so that they could privatize it, which is what these groups wanted, and which a lot of Wall Street's interests, some of whom directly funded these efforts, wanted as well. And there was no opposition to them for like 15, 20 years, you know. They were able to just go around saying this, and there was, you know, the groups that you would have expected to have countered them, like the AARP, for example, just didn't do it. And so they managed to create this. And once you create a myth like that over a long period of time, it takes quite a bit of resources to counter it.
And the idea is to privatize it, in effect, or make that money available for private investment
services?
Sure,
and just a couple of years ago, I mean, President Bush did propose a partial privatization, and he thought he could get away with it. And if it wasn't for the, you know, it was quite a big grassroots effort, which we participated in as well as a think tank. And if it weren't for that effort, who knows, he might have gotten away with it.
One of the other issues that the Center for Economic and Policy Research has been at the forefront on, both you and Dean Baker, has been alerting people to the bubbles in the economy that were looming, the stock market bubble in the late 90s, and then more recently, the housing bubble. You guys were really ahead of the curve on this of almost any group in the country that I'm familiar with. And when I was reading your most recent column, you had a statement that I thought was really striking, that the number one media source on the housing market over the last couple of years in the news media when covering the issue of the housing market was a gentleman named David Lira. I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation.
Laria.
Who is David Laria, and what does it tell us about our media coverage that he's their number one source on the housing market?
Yes, well, at the time he was chief economist for the Realtors Association, and he was author of that book, Why the Real Estate Boom Will Not Bust and How You Can Profit From It.
Good one, pal.
Yeah, well, you remember Dow 36,000? I mean, that was another great one. And those people are still, you know, they're in the media all the time. There doesn't seem to be any punishment for having a bad track record.
No, maybe they get a job in the State Department.
Well, that would be punishment. But no, they seem to just go on and become you know, commentators at higher and higher levels. But, no, it's the sourcing problem. And, you know, it is quite striking because these are two of the biggest asset bubbles in the history of the world, and it shouldn't have been left to a little think tank here on Connecticut Avenue in Washington. I mean, Dean, my colleague, Dean Baker, was the first economist and practically the only one in the country to show mathematically, which you could actually show in the late 90s, that the stock market prices of that time were not compatible with any future plausible growth projections for the economy. So on that basis, you could actually show that it was a bubble and it was going to burst. And he was also the first to analyze the housing bubble beginning in 2002. But it is quite amazing. I think some change will come out of this because it was the bursting of these bubbles that have caused our last two recessions, the last one being in 2000 from March to November, I'm sorry, 2001 from March to November when the stock market bubble broke. It caused a recession. And then we have now the housing bubble, which, you know, rescued us from the last recession, is just beginning to burst now and is causing a recession which has either already started or will start in the near future.
Now, how serious, Mark Weisrath, do you think the economic problems the United States is in or entering are, and I mean, do you think they're a short-term adjustment or that simply a bubble that got a little bit out of hand that we just have to sort of bite the bullet and get back on our feet and everything will be fine? Or, in your view, are there maybe deeper problems that need to be addressed before we can ever see sustainable growth?
Well, this is, I mean, we're heading into a recession, and again, if it hasn't already started, and It is more likely to be a deep recession like the one we had, the double dip recession from 1980 and 1982, than it would be the relatively mild recessions we had back in 1991 and in 2001. So I think it will be a serious recession. And it's because of the size, the magnitude of what we're dealing with here. There's, you know, $8 trillion of excess bubble wealth that was created in this huge, unprecedented run-up in home prices. And along the way, you had a massive amount of borrowing against this paper wealth that was created, and that has fueled the economic recovery that we've had over the last 6 years since the last recession. And so now all of that is working in reverse. So whereas before, you know, not only the construction sector and the housing-related sectors, but also the massive borrowing, you know, which was running in 2005 at an annual rate of $780 billion that people borrowed against their homes and spent an awful lot of that. That is what fueled this boom, and now that's suddenly being turned off and going in the other direction as people are losing, you know, they're losing homes. Those who are staying in their homes are losing value. They can't borrow against them. And then there's, of course, the whole credit crunch as well in the financial sector. So that has gone along with this because of the bad mortgage-backed securities that are, you know, that went throughout the financial system. Now that problem, you know, the media has focused mostly on that, but that problem could be resolved, and you'd still have this problem in the real economy. In other words, even if you didn't have the credit, the problems in the financial sphere, you still have this problem caused by the bursting of the housing bubble, just as the bursting of the stock market bubble directly caused the recession of 2001. The bursting of this housing bubble would cause a recession, and a more serious one, even if there were not these problems of dubious mortgage-backed securities throughout the financial system.
Now, Mark Weisbrod, let me turn the question around in a way then. If, in fact, our economy needed to a large extent to have the stock market bubble of the late 90s to sort of keep it growing, and it needed the housing bubble of the last 5 or 6 years to keep it growing, I mean, does our economy require these sort of crazy bubbles otherwise to avoid stagnation?
Well, that is a great question, and I can't remember the last time a journalist asked us that.
Well, I'm a journalist, I guess, so.
You know, it's a very good question, and this gets into something which a lot of people, which hasn't really got a lot of attention, but probably should. I would say that it has required these bubbles mainly because of the massive trade deficit we have. Okay, so in other words, if you have a huge trade deficit, which ours is now about 5.2% of GDP, which is, you know, enormous, right? If you're running that kind of a trade deficit, that's subtracting that amount from your economy automatically as a matter of accounting. So something else has to make up for that. And so I would say that that what those bubbles really are is our way, our economy's way of compensating for the lack of demand that you see in the demand that we're losing in the international sector. And that, you know, that's mainly because of our currency being overvalued. The dollar has been overvalued for many, many years now. It's come down now since 2002, and so the trade deficit is now gradually being reduced. But I think that you could say that is, in some sense, one of the root causes of the problem.
Well, Mark Weisbrod, what do you make of the caliber of the debate over the economy in the presidential race so far on both the Republican and Democratic side?
Well, I think there are some good issues being raised. I mean, health care, for example, is very important. And some of the proposals put forward on the Democratic side would, both of the candidates' proposals would, if they were fully implemented, would bring us closer to a universal everybody, regardless of their own will, would they have the will even at the level of Congress and the presidency to oppose these very powerful lobbies, especially the insurance lobby and pharmaceutical lobby, two of the most powerful lobbies in the country, to actually implement a health care reform. But the fact that it's on the agenda is definitely a step forward. I think the fact that also Hillary Clinton, for example, causing for a strategic pause in the trade agreements is also a positive step and a reaction to mass sentiment that is, you know, on an issue where the media is solidly against the popular interest as it can be. So that's also positive. On the economy itself, I think the proposals have been so far rather weak. I mean, the country is going to need a serious fiscal stimulus, and that's not really being talked about.
And just for the sake of listeners who haven't taken economics, and fiscal stimulus means explicit government spending, injecting money into the economy.
Yes, through government purchases of goods and services, not just by lowering interest rates, or as the Federal Reserve is now doing, just throwing money at the banks.
Yeah, that Federal Reserve just this week, I think the total now has come to $1 trillion that the Federal Reserve and central banks have thrown at this problem. And, you know, as I hear this and see this in the news media and the coverage, mostly in the business press where it's covered extensively, where does this $1 trillion come from? How come when the economic system's in problems, people in Wall Street start whining, they can come up with $1 trillion so easily?
Well, the Federal Reserve can print as much money as they want. That's what they do when they, that's how they, it's the equivalent of printing money. It's not actually cash, but they inject money into the banking system whenever they lower interest rates. That's, you know, so they can do that as much as they want. There's a risk of inflation, of course, I think the Fed has correctly decided that the risk of the further downturn in the economy is much worse. The bad part of what they're doing is they are kind of bailing out the banks and the financial institutions who should have to pay the cost of the bad loans that they have made. They're the ones who ultimately should be responsible. And, you know, CBER has put forward a very simple proposal, which is going to be introduced as a bill in Congress, which actually bails out the homeowners instead of the big bankers. It would just allow people basically to stay in their homes if they're about to be foreclosed as renters indefinitely, with an independent appraiser appointed by the court to set the value, the market value of the rent, just as they appraise houses today. And this would keep people from being evicted. It would, help relieve the blight of the neighborhoods, and it would also very strongly encourage the banks and financial institutions to renegotiate the terms of the mortgages so that people could stay in their homes, because they don't usually want to become landlords. So this would be a way of, again, it wouldn't even cost taxpayers anything, but it would put the burden on the people who made these bad loans, sometimes even deceptive loans, and you could also limit it to, households that bought a house below the median price, so you don't have to bail out people with multi-million-dollar homes.
Which members of Congress are supporting this?
Well, so far, I think Raul Grijalva from Arizona is going to, I know that he's been working on it. There will be others that will sign on, I'm sure. I just haven't seen them. It's just getting there, you know, it's just being circulated right now. But I hope it gets somewhere. I don't, you know, again, this is the kind of thing where the banking committees and the finance committee, and there's going to be a lot of opposition from the banking industry. But this is, you know, it really shows how corrupt our government is, in a sense. You know, when I read these things, I always think of how, because here in Washington, all the experts are always trashing these middle-income countries, and of course, even especially low-income countries, for their corruption and how their governments can't do the simple things that are in the best interest of people. And here we have a perfect example. I mean, you look at the proposals that might pass Congress that have the best chance, and their proposals to put as much as $100 billion, maybe even more, to the that would overwhelmingly go for the banks and wouldn't even help the homeowners very much. You know, to actually and here you have the very simple solutions, don't cost the taxpayers anything, and would simply impose the loss on the people who made the mistakes, which is the way capitalism is supposed to work. I mean, that's the way markets are supposed to work, right? They made a bad loan. In many cases, they just assumed that home prices were going to go up indefinitely. They made all kinds of mistakes. And yet, you'll see what an uphill battle it'll be to even get a hearing for this.
Our guest, Mark Weisbrot. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. We've only got about 7, 8, 9 minutes left, so I just want to turn now to the presidential race and the press coverage of the presidential race. You wrote a column not too long ago, Mark Weisbrot, saying basically, as if I recall, that Obama plays the media like a violin. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think he was very clever in his media strategy. You know, he started out his campaign not challenging, you know, any powerful interests and speaking in terms that the media really liked, about putting partisan, you know, differences aside, getting everybody together, those kinds of things that the media likes. And in the first primary, you know, in Iowa, he lost New Hampshire, but even in that primary, if you look at his voters and all the way through February 5th, Super Tuesday, Obama was winning. He was winning majorities among the independents and the upper income voters, and losing the traditional working class, below 50,000 household income, union households, all the traditional Democratic base. And then he knew exactly that he was, you know, he couldn't really win the whole election like this, and he switched right before Wisconsin and started taking a more populist tone and talking about NAFTA. And one of his big, you know, his great throwaway lines was when Hillary said, you know, speeches don't put food on the table, and he said, well, you know, NAFTA didn't put food on the table either. And so he took these much more populist positions on economic issues, and he lost some media support. There's no doubt about it. The New York Times, the Washington Post, both criticized him for it, but he won Wisconsin quite easily, and he's held his own, even though he lost Texas and Ohio, you know, in the delegate count. He's still right about where he was even after that. And so I think that, you know, he kind of knew when he knew how to stay within the limits of the media, what the media wanted, except when he had to go past that in order to get to the next stage.
You know, right now, it looks on paper, I think by all accounts, this would be an election you would expect to go overwhelmingly to the Democrats, not just in Congress, but in the presidential run, in view of the state of the economy combined with what's happening still in Iraq and around the world. Yet, I think there's a lot less certainty among Democrats or even Republicans, to their happiness, today that that'll be the case, in view of sort of the fighting going on between Clinton and Obama. What's your take on the situation?
Well, it could hurt them. I don't know that it's going to hurt them as much as some people think, because the other thing it does, on the positive side, it keeps them in the news all the way. If it goes all the way to the convention, then that, you know, the news kind of, a lot of the media forgets a little bit about McCain. And it keeps the Democrats in the news more. So it cuts a little bit both ways, although it's not good overall. I'd say, you know, it is probably net negative to have them still competing this far, and especially, I think Hillary's run more of a negative campaign too against Obama. But I think that it is theirs to lose. I mean, with this kind of a recession and the war, you know, it's just incredible if they can't, you know, get a very large gain in the Congress and win the presidency. I mean, it would take some kind of major incompetence or maybe they're unforeseen events, right? We don't know, a terrorist attack or something like that. But, you know, McCain is going to try and scare people, and he's going to run a, you know, very fear-based kind of campaign. But, I just don't think, again, especially with the economy the way it is, I don't think it's really feasible unless the other side really screws up.
Some people argue that Obama and Clinton basically have pretty much identical voting records, except for a few marginal differences. And it's sort of the classic case then of Coke and Pepsi. When Coke and Pepsi advertise against each other, they can't really talk about their products since they're basically synonymous. So they have to do fictitious stuff about friendliness and sex appeal and all that sort of stuff. And so for Hillary Clinton to catch up, she's really forced to make up issues to distinguish herself that really aren't all that relevant. And that gets into the negative mudslinging. Do you think that's an accurate portrayal of how Obama and Clinton compare? Do you think, from your analysis of the two of them, there are real differences in where they stand on issues and what sort of presidencies they would have?
I don't think there's a... No, I mean, in terms of the positions they're taking, they're not huge differences. Although there are some visible differences on foreign policy. You know, Obama saying he's willing to talk to other countries, that's not trivial. Because that is one of the main ways that our government promotes these kind of state of warlike relations, hostile relations with countries like Iran, for example, or Venezuela. I mean, it's ridiculous mm-hmm. not to talk to Venezuela. It's ridiculous not to talk to any of these countries. So, you know, Obama's saying that, and, you know, his response to the Andean crisis, for example, that we just discussed, was different. You know, Hillary called Chavez a dictator and tried to blame him and go with the Bush administration line, whereas Obama had a somewhat better position, saying that everybody should try to get together and avoid a conflict. And, you know, I think Democrats have a real problem in terms of foreign policy. I mean, to the extent that they accept the basic premises that we're in a hostile world where all these people are out to get us for no reason that has anything to do with our foreign policy, and then it does kind of play into a McCain strategy of I'm going to be the meanest bastard you can elect, and therefore you should vote for me. Again, you know, if you accept too much of the premises of that foreign policy, if you don't see that almost, you know, that the vast majority of the problems that the United States faces are almost all of them, really, that said that we have problems in the rest of the world that there are of our own making. You're always going to be vulnerable. They're always going to be vulnerable. The next terrorist attack or major, who knows what happens in the world where our government can get into a conflict somewhere. Everything could change.
Mark Weisbrot, we've only got less than a minute left. So, Mark, if you could just quickly let me know what the Center for Economic and Policy Research is working on. If we go to your website at cepr.net, what sort of stuff will we be seeing in the coming weeks and months?
Well, we'll be tracking the economy very closely, as we always do, and people can subscribe to those things, the U.S. economy. And we'll be putting out more on current topics, especially in Latin America as well.
Well, Mark Weisbrot, thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters. It's been a pleasure having you. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, and Mike Pritchard for doing the taping for us. I'll see you all in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Today in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny with a high of 45 degrees, winds out of the northeast at 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, increasingly cloudy and cool, the low 32, east winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly cloudy with rain beginning later in the day, the high 52, breezy with southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour and gusting. This is WILL Urbana. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. There's no shortage of topics to discuss with veteran journalist Geraldo Rivera, the presidential election, the scandal and resignation of New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, but he joins us to talk about immigration.
We're not going to round them up, put them in cattle cars. You know, that's just not going to happen. The nation can't stand that kind of trauma. So we've got to recognize that they're here. We've got to give them some path to emerge from the shadow, emerge from the terror that some ICE agent's going to come busting into your house at 3 in the morning.
Also, we continue with the fifth installment of our special series, Below the Line, The Changing Face of American Poverty. Then, author George Frazier offers tips for networking and building relationships with his new book, Click. Plus, rising film star Kiki Palmer talks about life after Aquila and the Bee. This hour of the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, after the news.